The Virginia Voice presents What's Your Story? Our program is based on the idea that everybody has a story to tell. All you have to do is ask. Now, here's the host of What's Your Story, Don Dale.
My guest this time on What's Your Story is John Witt, who's a retired journalist and now an actor, and has had a couple of other interesting jobs along the way, which we'll touch on. But, John, we start our program with a question that almost always prompts a conversation. What's your earliest childhood memory?
I know that's a tough question for a lot of folks. It's not for me.
Good.
Because my very first memory was so important in who I turned out to be that it really has stuck with me. And I guess I was about three, somewhere along in there. I was just at the point where I was going outside the house to explore the great world. And our front yard was fairly flat, but there was a steep bank that was lined with ivy. Somehow I managed to trip and fall and get ensnared in the ivy. Now, the harder I struggled to get loose, the more entangled I became, and I did what every brave young man would do. I began to cry and yell for my mommy.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly I realized, now this didn't take very long, this would have been a minute or two, but it occurred to me that mommy wasn't coming. And there was nobody on the street, I was all alone. When you're three, you don't have a whole lot of life to flash in front of you, but I figured it was all over. But then suddenly I realized, okay, if nobody else is going to help me, I'm going to get out of this on my own. So I went from panic to calm, and I got one hand free, used it to free the other hand, used both hands to free my torso till I could sit up, and then I scooched myself up the bank until I was safe in the yard. I went in the house, and it like nothing had ever happened. And it occurred to me that that has made me very self-sufficient. I'm not afraid of anything. In fact, I'm a little bit of an adrenaline junkie. And so I figured that any risk I took, somehow, if I stayed calm and did what logic told me to do, I would somehow dig myself out of any hole. And that stood me in good stead for the rest of my life.
That's one of the most amazing stories. I get all kinds of answers to that question. That's a good one, though. Where was all this?
This was in Roanoke, Virginia. I'm a Virginia native, Star City of the South. The Mill Mountain Star was erected in the year of my birth. I don't think there was any association there.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, and the Star City, it was a great place to grow up because, you know, my father's side of the family were city folk, and they saw to it that I got to travel and see things and learn things. My mother's side of the family were country folk, and I learned to hunt and fish and grow vegetables and, you know, all kinds of things. So I got the best of both worlds in a town that was just big enough to have all of those experiences available.
That sounds almost like you're describing an idyllic childhood.
It was. I went to school in a fairly normal suburban setting, among fairly normal suburban kids. But every summer, I would kick my shoes off in June when school let out, and I didn't have to wear shoes again until September when school started again. My family would summer in this rustic cabin on the shores of Craig Creek, and I would take inner tubes down the rapids all day, see how long I could hold my breath underwater, smoke corn silk cigarettes, climb cliffs and trees. You know, it was wonderful stuff, and I wish I could go back there.
Well, how long did you stay in Roanoke?
Until I went to college, and I got married while I was in college, and then we moved to Richmond. Went back to Roanoke for a few years, and then back to Richmond. So I've lived in one place or the other my whole life.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Emory and Henry College. It's a long story about how I got there, small liberal arts school in Southwest Virginia. And what was good about that was I didn't have to figure out what my major was going to be. I did things I enjoyed doing. It took a lot of theater, of course, and I was an English major, so I was exposed to the literature. But it was a good, solid liberal arts education. I learned to read and write and think, and you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
And came to Richmond after that?
Yes. Actually, the first paycheck I ever earned was as an actor when I was 10.
What did you do?
put on a kilt and the world's worst Scottish accent, and I played a Scottish prince named Thrifty Christie for a bank promotional campaign. They were trying to sell kids on a savings plan where you would bug your parents for the loose change in their pockets, put it in a machine, get stamps, put them in a book. When the book was full, you had a $25 savings account.
So this was a television commercial?
It was TV. There were press conferences. There were school visits. And I spent a couple of weeks actually going to branch banks to introduce it and try and con customers into pumping their nickels, dimes, and quarters into the machine.
At 10 years old.
But even before that, I had the bug. I mean, I guess when I was old enough to talk, I was doing puppet shows and magic shows for the neighborhood kids. And when I was 4, I got the lead role in the kindergarten pageant as Davy Crockett. And I got that, you know, coonskin cap, fringe coat, the whole deal. I got that because I'd sent away peanut butter wrappers and got a record of the theme song. So I was the only kid in the kindergarten class who knew all the words. So I was Davy Crockett.
This was in the era when Davy Crockett was a television program.
It was Walt Disney. It was TV. It was a national phenomenon.
It was ubiquitous.
Yeah. And then you know, not only my first paycheck, but my first real job, my first steady job, was as a carny barker at an amusement park. So, you know, step up, sailor, show the little lady the strength of your arm, knock over 3 cats, win her a furry prize. And I did that for a few years. It didn't pay very much, but I got to ride the rides for free on my breaks.
So, and you were how old?
That was 14.
Wow.
So after that, high school and college, anytime they turned on the footlights, there I was. And I worked my way through Shakespeare and Oscar Wilde and Neil Simon and Rodgers and Hammerstein and all that stuff. And I loved it.
Do you sing?
They call it musical comedy for a reason.
Yeah, well.
And when I got out of college, you know, naturally I thought, well, I'd like to have something to do with the theater. And so my first job after college was teaching drama at George Wythe High School here in Richmond.
Wow.
Did that for a couple of years. And but finally, you know, my classes were great, but it was a very tense time. This was right after forced busing. The principal was shot at a football game. There were knife fights in the halls. It wasn't, once you left my classroom, the situation was pretty rough.
Yeah.
So I went back home looking for a job, got hired at the Virginia Employment Commission as an interviewer and watching job descriptions come across the desk. And there was one for a reporter at a local TV station. And I had no journalism background, but I could read and write, and I could shoot and edit 16-millimeter film. And so they hired me as the weekend news team. So I did all the interviews, holding the camera in one hand and the mic in the other, and asking the questions, recording the answers. I would go back, process and edit the film, and do 30 minutes of news, weather, and sports by myself at 11 o'clock on Saturday and Sunday night.
Which station?
WSLS.
Ah, yes.
At the time, it was a park station, and they had a reputation for hiring people as janitors and making them weathermen, you know, that kind of thing. It was very low rent. I was terrible. I would not have gotten a job anywhere else, but I loved it. And it was storytelling. It was the same as theater in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I could work in front of and behind the camera, in front of and behind the mic. And I could write, and I could edit, and I could, you know, and I could see things that other people didn't get to see. It was a great ticket to the front lines.
Yeah.
And so I went from there into radio, from there into newspaper, from there back to TV, then to wire service, and finally I wound up at the Richmond Times-Dispatch, where I spent 28 years as a reporter and editor, and left there in July of 2013. And after taking a long nap and a few motorcycle rides, the question came up, what do I want to do next? And what I really wanted to do next, because I was retired and I didn't have to worry about finding a job or going, you know, bagging groceries or anything like that. So it was acting again. And I'm now up to, I started out just doing background work, you know, the faces in the crowd, the people in the restaurant, the people walking down the street, and I've slowly gotten small speaking parts and working my way up, and I'm now up to, I think, 7 feature films and 9 television series, 2 radio plays, and an audio book. and I'm having a ball. It keeps me just busy enough to not get bored. There's nothing glamorous. I won't get rich. I won't get famous. But I'm having a great time.
You are a storyteller, and I can tell you've written for newspapers and for broadcasts because you've just summed up what would usually take a half hour of explanation.
Well, do we quit now?
What are we, about 10 minutes in? And yeah, we can go home now. I want to go back to your acting before you became a newspaper reporter and television reporter. What was your favorite role? What kind of stuff did you like doing?
I loved Shakespeare.
I really did.
And I think it's very relevant. And I think once you listen to the music of it and start to get in tune with the archaic language, you realize that he was a tremendous writer and was all about the human condition. And one of my favorite roles was, I actually was in a Shakespearean repertory company, so I would play a different role in a different play every night. And I was cast in Romeo and Juliet as the bad guy. His name was Tybalt. He killed Romeo's best friend in a sword fight. Then he took on Romeo. And this was elaborately choreographed. We had a fencing master come in.
It has to be.
And you know, every thrust and parry was carefully choreographed. We knew every step we were going to make. But we had also, for realism's sake, we ground the safety tips off the rapiers, the fencing foils. And so they had a sharp edge. Now, the way the fight was supposed to end, after going back and forth, I disarm Romeo, he runs behind a fruit cart, and I go in for the kill with my back to the audience and my face to the cart. Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst to me, Romeo's friend tosses him a sword. He sticks it through the cart, and you know the audience doesn't see it, doesn't make contact. I turn around, I have a death scene. The woman who plays my mother comes out and makes this elaborate monologue about how the Montagues and the Capulets have to stop this bloody feuding, and that's the end of the scene. But what happened is it's opening night. It's an amphitheater, open air, full moon, full crowd, and the newspaper critic is in the front row. We're all excited. We're pumped. And that sword fight was fiercer than it had ever been, and when I ran into the cart, I knocked it back a few inches, and he stuck the sword out a little farther than he normally did. It went about an inch into my stomach, right above the navel. And when I turned around, all of a sudden, I looked down, and there's blood spurting between my fingers, and I feel this sharp pain, and my eyes roll back in my head, and I go down to my knees, and I collapse on the stage. The woman who plays my mother comes out, looks down, sees the blood, faints, and has to be dragged off the stage. So there is no scene-ending monologue, and all the other actors are looking at each other in total shock because they don't know whether to help me or whether to ad-lib something to try and end the scene. The lights go out, and the scene ends. And the next day, I got a glowing review about my gripping destiny.
Yes, well, you know, it's funny in retrospect, and I was laughing while you were telling the story, but that's a serious stage accident.
Things happen. You know, yeah. Sets collapse and fall on people.
People get hurt.
Once I played a blind man, and I insisted on actually being blindfolded. And the way it worked was another actor had to point me to the side of the stage, and I would walk across the stage and disappear. And one night I was pointed slightly off, just a few degrees, and I wound up taking a step off the stage, and fortunately I landed on the piano, and there was this big loud clang. The audience starts to laugh in a very serious scene, and then I had to go fight my way through the curtains to disappear. So yeah, things happened, but that's what made stage acting, and it was part of the thrill. You know, you never know when somebody's going to forget a line and you're going to have to go on with the show, or something totally unexpected happens. So that's part of the fun.
I want to remind our listeners that we're talking with John Witt, who's a retired journalist and now an actor. And I want to go back to the journalism part. Did you have a favorite beat? Was there an aspect of journalism that interested you more than anything else?
I really did. And it was great to be a generalist. And I pretty much always was. I never had, well, I won't say never, but most of the time I was a bureau reporter, which is like being a foreign correspondent, whatever the story is. One day you're on a farm. The next day you're at NASA watching them launch missiles. The next day there's a hurricane coming. You know, there's all kinds of things going on. But my favorite beat was always courts and cops. It was, you know, Charles Dickens was a great court reporter. And
I didn't know that.
He did. He started out in the covering court cases in Britain. And, of course, what he said and what I agree with is that you see people at their best and their worst. These are very emotional situations with lots at stake. The arguments go back and forth. You don't know which side's going to win. It's this great struggle of right and wrong and justice and all of that. So watching that was a lot of fun. And the best case I remember was one that was actually made into a movie. I covered it for UPI. It was in Roanoke in federal court. And it was Jerry Falwell versus Larry Flynn.
Oh, my goodness.
Reverend Jerry Falwell, of course, was the leader of the Moral Majority and a televangelist, very famous. And Larry Flynn was the
Hustler magazine.
Was the publisher of Hustler magazine. And what it was all about was Flynn thought that Falwell was this huge hypocrite and would attack him whenever he had a chance. And one of the things he was doing is he had these fake liqueur ads. It was Campari. Actually had a campaign at that time, a real ad campaign, My First Time. And they had these celebrities, and it was all this double entendre where you were supposed to think they were talking about losing their virginity, but they were actually talking about the first time they drank Campari. So Flint did these phony versions, and he had Jerry Falwell's picture in front of an outhouse. And Jerry Falwell said, "My first time was with my mother in an outhouse and a goat." And it was the most tasteless thing you can imagine. But Falwell was a public figure. This was satire. And Falwell sued him for intentional infliction of emotional distress and for libel. And the trial was fascinating. It was a media circus, as you can imagine.
Yeah. Everybody
and
knew about it.
I won't tell you about the exhibits, which were these 6-foot-high cartoon panels, are just some of the grossest things you can imagine. And Falwell's attorney was quoting Shakespeare in the Bible, and the Flint's attorney was this Hollywood entertainment type who was just very flashy and wore suits more than I could make in a year. And it was wonderful to watch them go at each other. In the end, the jury came out with this split verdict. They found that Flint was not guilty of libel because Falwell was a public figure, and he was, you know, we have the First Amendment in this country. But they found him guilty of intentional infliction of emotional distress because it was one of those in-your-face, you know, I'm talking about your mama.
Yeah.
But
and an outhouse and a goat.
It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And
yes,
the Supreme Court kicked it out because they said that the two had to hang together. Mm-hmm. There could be no intentional infliction of emotional distress unless there was libel. No libel. You can't do the other thing. So it had been a token award anyway. It was like $50,000 in damages, which either one of them would spend on lunch that afternoon.
Yeah.
But it was a moral victory for Falwell until it went to the Supreme Court, and then it was a moral victory for Flint. And they wound up making a movie out of it. Woody Harrelson played Flint in a wheelchair, and it was called The People versus Larry Flint. And if you haven't seen it, you ought to watch it. It's a good movie.
I'll put it in my Netflix queue. Well, that certainly is a fascinating story. Were there other stories like that that you covered in your career?
It would be impossible to have more fun and get paid for it. I sailed with Jacques Cousteau. I flew with the Blue Angels. I covered a couple of Muhammad Ali's fights from ringside. I met presidents and queens. And you know, it was just a wonderful set of life experiences. And the difference between that and what I do now is then I got to sit down with people and peer into their lives and see how they lived and talk to them and learn about all of these experiences that they had. Now I get to pretend to be those people. You know, in the last few months I've been a Confederate general, a soul-sucking ghost, the boss of a NASCAR pit crew, you name it, a patriot, all kinds of things.
When did you retire? How old were you?
I was 64 years old, and it was a little bit early, but it was time.
Were you still at the Times-Dispatch?
I was still at the Times-Dispatch. I was the editor of Times-Dispatch.com.
That's a hell of a responsibility.
It was.
And you edited the Sunday.
I was the editor of the Sunday paper for about 10 years, and then I went to the digital side. Well, it was. The editor of the Sunday paper was a wonderful job because basically 3 nights a week I was a senior editor in the newsroom. So when the D.C. sniper hit Ashland, mm-hmm. you know, we had to tear up the paper between editions and cover that. Mm-hmm. Reagan died. The Pope died. Mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein was captured. All those things happened while I was in the hot seat, and it's extremely stressful, but it's extremely rewarding when you see it pay off the next day. Yeah. I went to the digital side and was the TD's first multimedia editor. I had to teach people to use video and audio and slideshows and the tools of online to tell their stories better to a different audience. Yeah. And then I was editor of TimesDispatch.com. Now that's where it started to wear on me a little.
Yeah.
Because a mentor of mine once told me that the higher you rise in journalism, the farther away you get from the fun of the business. And to me, it was the storytelling. It was the writing. It was the editing. And, you know, leading a project was a lot of fun, too. But when what you're worried about are how many people clicked on this link and clicked on that link today or yesterday, or how can we get revenues up, or how can I manage the flaming idiots who are posting obscenities on in the comments section? You know, it schedules and personnel reviews and all the things that are no fun,
right.
All of a sudden we're taking a little larger role in my day-to-day life. So when the time came, it was a mutual thing. They wanted me out of there because I was making too much money, and I wanted out of there because I need to relax a little bit. It was very stressful, 60-hour weeks, and you get calls at 2 o'clock in the morning when something was on fire and they wanted to know what we were going to do about it. And it was just, you know, it was a lot of headache and not as much fun as I had been having. So now I'm back to the pure fun.
I want to talk about what you've been doing since retirement, but I think, in a way, people will need a mental image of what you look like. You are medium height, with a gray tending to white mustache.
Oh,
beard.
Go ahead. Let's level with the folks. I have a white beard.
It's mostly white.
It's shorter than Santa Claus, and I'm
right.
A little slimmer than Santa Claus.
Sort of Robert E. Lee style.
I have been mistaken for Robert E. Lee.
And the hair is once brown.
We can call it salt and pepper.
Salt and pepper now. Okay, so this sets up their image of you. What kind of roles have you been playing?
Well, that's how I got back into it. I was still at the newspaper in 2010, and we were actually having a front page meeting. All the editors were there from the different departments pitching their stories for page one. Mm-hmm. And the features editor said, well, you know, Steven Spielberg is in town, and he has an open casting call for extras for Lincoln. And they're looking for men with beards. And all the heads turned to look at me, and people started to snicker. And it was a joke, and I took it as a joke. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, that would be a lot of fun, and it would make a pretty good story. So that's what I did. I went down and stood in line with a couple hundred outlaw bikers and aging hippies and, you know, hipsters to be. And I got the part, and I was cast as a congressman opposed to the abolition of slavery. But during the 2.5 weeks of shooting at the state capitol, because I was an extra, which means, and they actually called it background, because that's where you are. You're mm-hmm. out of focus. You're not. You know, your face in the crowd. I was able to be a Republican in favor of abolition. I was an abolitionist celebrating the passage of the amendment. I was a journalist covering the debate. I was a VIP at Lincoln's second inauguration. So after 2.5 weeks of just having a ball, Steven Spielberg directed every scene. I got to watch some of the best actors in the world work. I thought I was done, and I went back to work. And they called me every now and then, you know, can you come down to Petersburg? We're doing crowd scenes. No, thank you. I'm out of vacation. I'm back at work. I really need to do this. One Sunday, I get a call from the casting director. Now, usually you get an email from his junior assistant, but I got a call from the casting director, and he said, I have an offer you can't refuse. Well, you know, we'll see about that. And what he said was, whenever they do a scene with real historical personages in it, they look for people whose faces match. And so he said, I look like Lincoln's pastor. The last scene in the film that they were going to shoot was the death scene. And so I got to be Lincoln's pastor in the death scene. There were only like half dozen people in the room, and they were all named actors except for me. It was Daniel Day-Lewis and Sally Field and the people who played his son and best friend and the Surgeon General and the Secretary of War. And the scene was Sally Field came in weeping as he laid on the bed in the boarding house across from the theater. She kissed his hand, collapsed. They dragged her out of the room. The Surgeon General puts a wooden stethoscope on his chest and says, "It's all over. The president is dead." I bow my head in prayer and open the Bible, and the Secretary of War says, "And now he belongs to the ages." And that's the famous quote that ends the movie. After that, there were some flashbacks to other scenes in the movie, but that was the climax. And to be in that, and you know, I got to see my face on the big screen 20 feet high. It was quite a thrill. So I went from the very top of the industry, and I've been working my way down ever since. It's almost a hobby. It's fun. One of my recent roles, I was in a show called The Haunting, and I got to play...
TV or...?
TV show.
Okay.
It was, I got to play a what they call a feeder ghost, which is kind of like a psychic vampire. And it took 2.5 hours in the makeup chair every day. You know, white face, black eyes, and I had to wear these white contacts, and it was just really very grotesque looking. And I got to hover over people in their beds and terrify them walking across the room and all. It was great fun to do this, you know, to play something that evil. And then right the one before that was a movie, it was a faith-based film about, it was a comedy about religious discrimination, if you can imagine such a thing.
No, I can't.
And I played a narcoleptic church deacon. And it was funny, it was fun, everybody around me was really good. I had plenty of lines in that one, and so I got to act a little bit. I played, fairly recently I did a show called Monsters and Mysteries in America. And I played a radar operator in a UFO incident where a police helicopter matches up against a flying saucer, and I'm trying to talk everybody down. And, you know, these kind of things are just, it's fun to do.
Do you, tick off some of your other roles quickly, because I want to...
Well, until last weekend, for the last couple of summers, I have played... a Confederate general at Tredegar, the American Civil War Museum at Tredegar. I was the owner of Tredegar, General Joseph Reed Anderson. I was wounded in defense of Richmond in the Seven Days' Battles. I met with Lincoln when Richmond fell. And my job there, it's a fascinating history. He was very racially progressive. He paid slaves to work in the place and gave them equal pay when they were emancipated. And
Anderson, this is.
Anderson did. And so I had to learn a lot of history because the people who come to Tredegar are serious Civil War buffs. But my job is to wander around the museum and find people wherever they are and strike up conversations about what they're looking at or what's impressed them or whatever questions they have. I've done a couple of Civil War things and a couple of Revolutionary War things. I don't know if you're familiar with an AMC show called Turn about the Revolutionary War.
Right.
I did 5 episodes of season 1 as a prisoner of the Redcoats.
It sounds like you're having a ball. One of the things I want to touch on very briefly is you're now reading for the Virginia Voice,
yes.
This very station that we're on. What do you read?
Whatever they ask me to. I guess I'm a pinch hitter. I've done everything from the Children's Hour to National Geographic to News and Perspective and, you know, a little of everything.
We invite our listeners to listen to the Virginia Voice and see if you can pick out John Witt. Our guest today has been John Witt, a retired journalist and now an actor. And you can tell he's a storyteller because I didn't have to do any work at all. All I had to do was open
now
the door.
That's what a wonderful interviewer you are.
Oh, is that what it is?
You just sit there and draw it out.
Thanks, everybody, for being with us today. I'm Don Dale, and I hope you'll join us next time on the Virginia Voice for What's Your Story?
You've been listening to What's Your Story with Don Dale. If you know somebody with a story to tell, or if you'd like to tell your own story, telephone the Virginia Voice, 804-266-2477, and be sure to join us next time for What's Your Story? This is Charles Mink speaking, and this is the Virginia Voice.